and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio Presents Holzer's Ghosts. Tonight, we take a look at An Ancient Evil, the episode that aired last Saturday on Discovery Plus, where we go to visit Mystery Hill, America's Stonehenge. Now, I want to start off the show a little different tonight. I've got three great guests that are going to join us. The son of the original owner, Dennis Stone, is going to join us in a few moments. Alexandra Holzer, paranormal investigator and daughter of Hans Holzer, will join us. And from America Unearthed and his special guest spot on this episode that we just filmed, Scott Walter will be joining us as well. But today, I have to start off. Everybody's blowing up my email because they knew we were going to be discussing America's Stonehenge. Today, news splashed across the headlines. New Jersey man used power tools to carve slogans into 4,000-year-old tablets at America's Stonehenge. People are up in arms. They want to know what's going on with this. So let's start off not talking about the show, but we're going to talk about what happened there so we can just put it to rest right away. Joining me, Dennis Stone. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Dave. Thank you so much for having me on this evening. Excited to be here.
Great to have you here. Now, you and I, we had a chance to meet long ago doing Midnight in the Desert and Darkness Radio. Now we get a chance to visit after recapping the episode, but we have to start off talking about this weird news. Give me a small encapsulation, if you will, of what happened and what's going on right now.
Yeah, on September 28th of 2019, our site was attacked, actually. And it happened probably in the early morning. It was a Sunday morning. And I was up working on the site, doing some leaf blowing. And the first thing I found when I was leaf blowing was a cross, about 18 inches, a wooden cross stuck in some trees, about 300 feet from what we call the main site. So it was out on a trail we call the Astronomical Trail. It takes you out to the alignments. And as I was leaf blowing, I looked to my right and I saw this big cross on the tree. I'm like, wow. I had been there that evening on Saturday evening, night before, and saw nothing with my dogs when I was walking them. I looked at it. It had pictures on it. I told my wife on the phone. I said, this is what I have. This is what the pictures say on the back. It was some eerie stuff. So she said, you better bring it down. So I went down with the leaf blower, came back with the ATV, brought it back. I resumed painting on our visitor center. We did the outside. And while I was doing that, the police were coming to look at this. And in the meantime, my wife came out about, oh, maybe quarter of 12. I think I picked up the cross around 11. So I'm painting for 40 minutes or whatever. She goes, hey, some customers said that the table has some marking on it. It's the sacrificial table, one of the main features of the site. About a 9,000-pound stone on four legs. And it's on your show, of course. You know, you've seen it. And I went, oh, great. Somebody put some spray paint on it, perhaps crayons or even like wax. People burn wax candles on it and stuff like that. When we're not there, they're not supposed to, of course. Well, I drove up there on my ATV and I get off. I'm walking towards it from about 100 feet or maybe roughly that. And I can see it in the distance and I'm looking at the top of the table, which I should not be. And I'm like, why am I looking at the top of the table? And it looked very, very pale in color. It's kind of a dark gray granite. And as I walk closer to it, I get into the area. I noticed that all the walls around it, there's all these walls and standing stones. They're all this kind of covered with this grayness. And I'm like, did somebody come in here and spray paint everything? And then I finally focused on the table and I noticed there was markings on the table and it dawned on me that all the stuff I saw was dust. And I'm like, oh my God, I almost fell over. I looked at the top of the table and engraved in about 12-inch letters and deeply cut into the stone up to about maybe 4 or 5 inches were words across the table, a Christian, and then some more letters at the bottom. And I almost fell over backwards, called my wife up. So that was done probably that Sunday morning, the 9th, we think. And it took quite a while to find this person that did it. They arrested him over 2 months ago. He's been sitting in jail in New Jersey. And just this week, they brought him up to New Hampshire. And the Salem police did a wonderful job. Mike Gears, detective, they actually had the FBI on this. And they had U.S. Marshals involved with this whole thing. We do know that this type of thing is going on around the country. I've done a radio show about that. And we try to keep this really low key because we don't want other people doing the same thing. You know, sometimes people do this. They pick up on this and they want to go out and do their own damage. But these sites across the nation, including around the world, are being damaged by people, you know, vandalism. And some of it's, I think, more ideally based too, you know. And in this case, apparently our table triggered this person's reaction. And I won't get into any politics of it. It's an open case. I think in April it might be going to the first to court, I think. So he may be getting out on bail. So this is all something I'm trying to find out from my county attorney, and I haven't got a call back from him. So right now it's open, and we don't want to talk too much about it. We'll be going to trial probably right. About a month and a half. And we hope that, you know, proper punishment is dealt out. You know, this kind of thing can't happen, you know. There was thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage, and the table has covered now forever in the winter unless you put a proper covering. Scott's a geologist. You'll have him on in a few minutes. And he told me even before the damage years ago that you should probably cover it. It's starting to get weather damage from cracks in the wintertime. They freeze, expand. But these four-inch roofs, it was about an inch diamond saw, really raised havoc. He actually knocked the table over. He busted one leg, the other leg over. So this 9,000-pound table came down, and it crushed what we call the Oracle tube, a six-foot tube that goes to the Oracle chamber, which was on your show on us. And it caused extensive damage to that tube. We think it's a speaking tube. A voice would travel through it. And that right. had to be all repaired, you know. So it took about 6 weeks to repair everything. And it just devastated our family. Friends and people that visit us were very, very upset about this whole thing. In 65 years, it's the worst thing we've ever seen in our museum. We hope to never have that again, you know. So,
and folks, if you know something, say something. If people are out doing these type of things, especially to historic sites like this, report it. And for God's sakes, don't go out, folks. You're not sticking it to the man by ruining these beautiful ancient sites. You know, stay at home, make angry videos on Facebook. That's much better for you than destroying these amazing sites, which need to be left alone and preserved. Amazing place. We had a chance to go out there this year, Dennis, as you know, and thankfully your family was willing to let us come back out and re-examine. Really briefly, when did your family take possession of Mystery Hill, America's Stonehenge?
Yeah, it was 1958. My dad actually opened it up to the public, and he did lease it from the owner, Malcolm Pearson, for a few years. My dad started buying up some of the other property around the hilltop to basically protect the entire hill from development. And so I opened it up, and my dad actually got involved with it 3 years prior to that on a radio show called Yankee Yarns. It was a big radio station out of Boston, which is still there. It's one of the oldest in New England. It's one of the biggest radio stations. And on a Friday night, the show wasn't about politics. It was about the strange stone ruins in Salem, New Hampshire. My dad lived 8 miles away and never heard of this place. And he was amazed that this place existed so close to him, and yet he didn't know about it. So 3 years after he first heard about it, he actually worked it out so we could actually open it to the public. So we've been going for 63 years now. It's been open.
63 years. And
going into our fourth
year. Tell me I'm sorry?
Oh, I missed it. Help for a second. Actually, the video stopped on you. I didn't catch the question. You actually stopped. The emotion stopped.
I didn't finish answering because you were talking, so I didn't want to interrupt you. But what year did Hans Holzer first come there and visit with you and your family?
I went through all the different files my dad had. The first thing I found were slides as well as some written stuff back in 1970. And he was there in 70 and 71. He was at a country club up in Derry, New Hampshire, where we were from, had kind of an evening with him at the country club, a supper. And we had the slides, but they actually, in 50 years, I was showing them to Alexandra. And actually, the slides went bad, so you can just barely make them out, you know, which is really unfortunate. And he was here in 72, 74. He brought in three different psychics. And in 75, he brought back another. And then in 70, he came back and he did the In Search of with Leonard Nimoy. He did the, I guess he directed it and he wrote the script on that, which came out in 1977. I think we were the second episode of Leonard Nimoy's 144 episodes. So we feel very fortunate to have Hans there. And one of my heroes from, you know, the 60s sci-fi stuff, Leonard Nimoy, you know, that was pretty cool. So,
oh, I bet.
And Hans wrote the book in 1992. So,
right. Let's bring on Hans Holzer's daughter, paranormal investigator, Alexandra Holzer. Alex, taking a little nip of the spirits, I see, to help bring yourself closer to that realm. I understand. So I've got the son of the owner. I've got the daughter of the investigator. And I've got this great picture.
Mm.
Right? There they are together. What's it like to...
Dad and Hans.
Yeah, to see that picture, Alexandra, to see your dad at Stonehenge and know you got a chance to literally follow in his footsteps with our investigation.
You know, it's something that I've always wanted to do anyway, and there's so many other places to cover, you know, and this was one of those situations where my father was a history buff. You know, he taught, he lectured, he had a million books on every subject matter, and the history was where it started for him. Not so much about how bad a haunting was or what people were saying, but where did these stones come from, the formation? Why was this the oldest Stonehenge in America? Why was it coined that phrase? So the curiosity runs deep in our bloodline. So the ability to be able to go out there and do this and then meet, you know, Dennis, and then knowing that our fathers had this starting relationship to start this process over the years in the 70s, you know, I grew up, I was born in 1971. The 70s is my era with the bell bottoms and like Velcro shirts and whatever. So I was like, yeah, I'm right there. And then we had a moment in the store when we were looking at the photos on the computer. And I'm like, because, you know, it's so emotional because it's my father and I know him. Nobody else really knows him, obviously, like we do. And everybody's around, you know, and I'm just like trying not to get emotional and trying to keep it together because he looks so different throughout the years. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, it's so funny. It's like when your parents are younger, you know, it's like a silly thing, but I was very focused on being there. And I want to go back, honestly, because there's so much more to be discovered there. And it's, I don't know, you know, it's a personal thing yet again, because it's my father. So everybody else is watching and they're partaking and it's wonderful, but there's a history there that I was born into. And these places are just, they're everywhere, you know, the history in general. So I just, you know.
Alex, talking about the history, this location really kind of stands out because this wasn't a one-off or two-off or even a three-off for your father. Your father went there over a dozen times over the span of like 7-8 years. To keep investigating, but it wasn't a case he really spoke to you much about the paranormal angle. And in the episode you mentioned, he felt that before he could even figure out who the ghosts were, he had to figure out who the spirits were, who had built that location and what its importance was. Do you think that he was ever satisfied with any of the answers that he got by the time he passed?
I believe mostly yes, and I'll tell you why. Number one, he dedicated a book to it because he was convinced that this is going back to the Phoenicians, the Vikings, and that history got it wrong. And that he wasn't one to say, oh, okay, whatever's written in the books, that's it. You know, he questioned everything. And if you're going to be in the field of, you know, cyclical research, which is really the proper term, and occultism and spiritism and all of that, you really have to question all of it. So just because something's published in a book and you're told, well, that's real, that's it, that's not the way this business goes. So he always knew that there was more to it. And had he had more time, I'm convinced that he would go back again. And if he was younger, I'd go with him because why wouldn't I? You know, I mean, who was there and how many tribes were there? How many energies are there? What's underneath the stones? There's layers, you know? So I believe he was felt justified in his findings. They carbon dated it. They went back. I mean, it was a whole thing. And I think he would have gone back again.
Well, talking about that rich history and why and who and what was there, when they told me about this episode, it's funny because Dennis and I had done a radio interview before Holzer Files even was being bandied about. And then I found out about Holzer Files. And after the interview, I'm like, hey, guys, you should really talk to this Dennis Stone character because he's got a location that Hans visited all the time. And they're like, yeah, we're aware, America's Stonehenge. So they're like, well, that might be like a season two. Season one, we're going to focus on some of the bigger, scarier, weirder places. Season two, let's try to go back and hit some of these outline, these interesting facets that were more about the history and getting it right. And I thought that was great. And then when they finally tapped me and said, Dave, we're going to do Stonehenge, I'm like, you got to talk to Scott Walter. I, you know, America Unearthed. He's a forensic geologist. He's a buddy of mine in Minnesota, and this guy knows his stuff. And they said, well, reach out to him and ask him if he'd even have an interest in doing it. And I did. And Scott, to his credit, was willing to come on for a ham sandwich and a half a glass of grape knee-high as his pay. But ladies and gentlemen,
Scott, it was a full glass, Dave. Come on. It was full.
All right. So a full glass of grape knee-high. Scott Walter, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dave. And what a great panel to be here with Alexandra and meeting for the first time. And to you, Alexandra, I've got my nightcap too. And Dennis is an old friend. He and I go back a long ways, and we've done a few things at America's Stonehenge. But, you know, I know we don't want to dwell on the negative, but I have to tell you, and Dennis knows this, that it really was a dagger to the heart for me, because when we did America on Earth, we went to a lot of sacred sites, and sadly, and I think that our show had something to do with this guy inspired to go to America Stonehenge. I don't want to dwell on that point, but there have been other sites that we have brought to the public's attention that have been damaged, in some cases destroyed. And I just don't get it. I really don't get it. But, you know, all it takes is one person to feel like they have a right to do something for whatever reason. And it's really sad and tragic. And that is why we try very hard when we went to many of these sites to not reveal the locations, because we were worried about something like this happening. But you know what? On the flip side, the person that did the restoration of the sacrificial table did an excellent job. And when I was watching the episode with you guys out there, I was looking to see if I could see any remnants, and I couldn't see anything. So it's about as good as it can be. So bravo to the people that did the restoration, Dennis.
Who knew?
I'll pass it on to him. Yeah.
Who knew it could look that good with hot glue and Legos?
Quiet. That's a secret.
I had no idea this happened. But literally, I'm touching this thing while doing this, and I'm sitting here, and I'm in my mind, I'm like, Betty, you're around us, right? You're here, right? I had no idea. So kudos, you know, because I didn't even – nothing.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, and hopefully this will go away and it'll be done. But now, Scott, let's talk about – this ancient land, this amazing location. Now, you don't necessarily believe that just one group used this site, right? You believe that it was built upon and spread out through time. Is that correct?
I think so. You know, I mean, one of the things about America's Stonehenge, in my view, it is one of the most, well, it might be the most important calendar site, astronomical observatory, ancient observatory in all of North America. And it has, you know, geographic providence. I mean, it's a high place. It's a perfect place to make an observatory. And these ancient people, these ancient cultures that used to come here, they would look for places like this. And, you know, we've talked about this going back at least 3,500 years, maybe farther back than that. And once it's established, maybe people heard about it that would come later. But even if they didn't, this would be a geographic place that people would go to make observations and build these standing stones, these structures. And, you know, it's one of the most important sites, but yet it has hardly been touched by the academic community. And to me, that is astounding, because it's such an important site. There are so many questions that can be answered if they would just take it seriously. And, well, I mean, I know why they don't, because it'll change the paradigm, the story that we've all been fed, that, of course, is BS. And you know what? I mean, whatever happened to truth and science and facts and evidence?
Right.
And get to the bottom of this. And the data is the data, the results are the results, and let's just go with it. I mean, we do that in so many other, you know, aspects of research. What's wrong with this place? This place is vitally important. It needs to be taken more seriously.
Well, what do you believe with this? You know, the concept of not changing history, like you said, other sciences are willing to readjust, right? 200 years ago, we thought putting leeches on people was the best healing, right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
we learned, oh, there's other things we can do. Bleeding people out is not necessarily the best healing modality. But if we found that there's a different part of this history, why are we not, why is academia and science staying away from it, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, it boils down to something very simple, and that is problems of what I call the human condition. And, you know, you'd be surprised. I run into people all the time, academics, that primarily work in what I call the humanities disciplines, not in hard science disciplines like archaeology, anthropology, language, and so forth. And what happens is these people, it's in many ways, it's more of an art than a science. And, you know, you said it yourself. We used to think, I mean, you know, sugar is good for you. Sugar, coffee is good. New studies say it's bad. The point is that if you are a true scientist and you take a position based on the science that you understood at a, you know, a particular time, and then all of a sudden new evidence comes in that supports a different conclusion. Now, what I see in a lot of cases is these people that hold this old position say, oh, I'm not going there. I'm standing by this position, because in their minds, they think, oh, I don't want to be proven wrong and look stupid. When in fact, what they should realize is that if new evidence comes in that dictates and in fact demands a new conclusion, you go there. And it doesn't mean that you're stupid. It means you're smart, because you follow the evidence. But I got to tell you, Dave, I can't tell you how many times people have just resisted this because they were so worried about how they would be affected. And when they need to realize it's not about you, okay? It's about getting the right answer. And I said, you know, I've said it more than once, if I made a mistake in any of the research or the work that I've done, point it out to me. I'll fix it. I'm not perfect. I can certainly make mistakes, but that's not what it ends up being. They just don't like the results for their own personal reasons. And this is what I mean by problems of the human condition.
Oh,
Alex, let me ask you this then, because it's a great lead-in for this fella, Dr. Hans Holzer. What part of what I love about Dr. Holzer and the work that he did was he followed that train, right? That if things changed, he was okay with that. If he learned more, and that's why he would visit some locations two or three times to try to get the story. And I have people asking now, you know, do you think Dr. Holzer would be pissed that you guys are sometimes rewriting what his findings were at the time? And my stock answer has been no. I think he'd be excited to know that we're getting to the truth on stories that were he was lied to, misled, things at those times, or the information just wasn't available. But what do you think about your father's take on the evolution of these stories through history?
Look, here's the deal. You know, we're always in constant motion. Energy is what we all are, is in constant motion. So we're going to have to evolve whether we like it or not. And the one thing that pissed him off, which pisses me off, is this constant imperative to keep everything neat and tight in a little box, because it's easier for everybody else. Well, you know what? It's true that. And that's the same way that he was. He had big balls. Let me tell you, pair of balls. But it went into the science of it. There's an intelligence that has to be had in the community. And, you know, he would have respected the fact that when you go back and you go to a location that you've been to 10 years go by, why are we so arrogant to believe that nothing would have changed and nothing would have come in and changed that energy or shifted or something would have happened? Life cannot be regardless. And so that is one of the things that really made him very angry and frustrated. So, yes, you have to go back several times. You have to go and you have to, just like I said, you make mistakes. That's part of the learning process. Science, you go in a lab and you make some kind of a serum and poof, there's a cure for something. That's not how it always works. Now, so he, you know, he would have known and understood that this a long time goes by, you know, five decades worth, something's going to change. And then the stories change and you have to go through all that BS and kind of sift through it, just like when somebody claims something's happening, There's a psychology added to that as well. You can't just go, oh yeah, I believe you. But you do it with respect to get the story and get the information so that you can get in there and then get down to work. And you have to be open-minded, you know, and just, you know, nobody's perfect, nothing's perfect. And nature, well, come on, you know, Mother Nature does what she wants to do. And I heard lately she got a divorce. So do not piss her off.
Hey, Alexandra, can I just jump in for a sec? There's one other thing that I think it's important to point out, Dave, and you make a good point, Alexandra, about energies change, and as time goes on, things change. Who would think that everything is static and stays the same? Of course it doesn't. But there's another big thing that I think your father probably would, if he was, you know, he probably is watching us right now and going, I wish I had that technology.
Yeah.
Dave has today that he did not have that would have, you know, opened things up tremendously for him. I mean, technology advances are huge, especially in this paranormal world, I've got to believe, in addition to just the natural world and the energy around it changing. Am I right about that, Dave?
Yeah, I believe so. And, I, you know, Alex, your dad's life's work was put into understanding energy and understanding history and how these things shift and sift through the sands of time. And we have to keep reevaluating the story to make sure that we're getting it right.
Absolutely. And have an open mind. Don't get frustrated or pissed off because you read a whole book on a subject matter and then somebody comes out in the scientific community and says, well, guess what we just found? You need to embrace and get excited about that and say, okay, where are we now? You know, so.
What? Well, let's take this back in. And Scott, we're going to come back with some of the science again in a few minutes. But Dennis, during the episode, Dennis, you mentioned that as a child, you had times you were afraid to go up there. Talk to me about those sensations and why you were afraid.
Yeah, I mean, we'd go back to when I was about a year old when I first went up there. And, you know, stories about the place, you know, and what the place could be. It just kind of left me as a child kind of a little bit afraid of the place, probably through into my teenage years. But it's changed too over time with me. You know, I feel the place is kind of peaceful and a lot of harmony up there is what I feel. You know, that's my experience today. But when I was a kid, I was a bit afraid to be up there. And at night, I didn't want to be up there at all. You know, so I don't know if it's from adults talking, you know, how kids pick up on stuff, you know, but I think it was a feeling I just had about the place, you know, and, not too many of us went up there at night. We get out of there, you know. So, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, we didn't stick around there at night. So, you know, we heard different things about the place, you know, folklore, legends, and stuff like that about the place.
Now,
it was probably the Underground Railway. We know that it was a place where the poor farm was for the town of Salem. But there's other things that we heard, too, that might have been a little bit more on the darker side, probably.
Can you give us an example?
Of what, the darker side?
Yeah.
Well, with the table, you know. Lots of things come up about the table, you know, and what type of ceremonies could have taken place there. Some of the chambers are reminiscent of some of the burial chambers in Europe. So if you're looking at a structure that people were placed in there, that also, even a cemetery gives you the goosebumps sometime. Yeah, that's, we call that the East-West Chamber. And it looks a lot like the galley graves or gallery graves found in, they're in Holland, they're in France, which I saw the ones in France, and they always run 20 to about 60 feet in length, and they always are orientated true east and west. You know, Scott's friends of mine, David Brody, was in Holland, I think in 2019, and he was texting me, and I said, hey, what's the orientation of that giant's bed? They call him, I think it's a Hoodenbidden, I think it's called. I can't pronounce it. This Scott probably can. But anyway, actually, it's one of these gallery graves. And he goes, well, it runs true east and west. And they were used for burial purposes. And next to that chamber that you just pulled up, the east-west chamber, there's a small structure called the V Hut. Looks like the letter V is in Victor. And my dad and I went in Ireland back in 83. We saw many different structures that reminded us of our site, but the wedge tombs over there. And the thing is, they're always facing southwest. And they were, again, used as tombs to our best knowledge. So as a kid, seeing this kind of stuff, you know, that's the kind of thing you're thinking about. People might have been buried in some of these structures, you know, kind of gives you that kind of feeling too, you know, a little scary feeling.
Let me ask Scott, what is the orientation of these graves and these chambers, east, west, north, south, southwest? What does that mean spiritually or to the alignments that that's where they would put bodies?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, many cultures even today have different burial rites and traditions that they feel are important that will help the, you know, the spirit, if you will, of that person to go where they need to go. And for example, the Essene, Jesus's people, had a tradition of burying their dead with their heads to the south. And I'm not really sure why that is. I know that there are certain traditions that bury their heads to the east, with their the dead with their head to the east, because that's where the sun rises. So there are many different traditions that have different practices. Some people, you know, put them in the ground, some put them in chambers, some put them in trees. Certain indigenous cultures will do that. And there's all kinds of different burial rites for all kinds of different reasons. But I think the main thing that they're trying to do is through this ritual, whatever it is, they're trying to get to spirit, to deity, whoever and whatever that might be. And so they go through these various rites to get there. And there's all kinds of them. So, but what is important is that the more you document about these chambers, about whatever you can, about their burial rites, that will help you identify who that likely culture was that was involved there.
Well, Scott, you had a gentleman join you on your program that had a very profound experience happen, and he came back to join us to talk a little bit about this. And I'll pop a quick picture of him up.
I know who you're talking about. Yes. Right. Brother Daryl Jameson, Black Eagle.
Black Eagle, that's right. And now, Black Eagle, as you could see from the picture, was a very jovial, happy fella. And then literally, as we're going up the hill, he stops me and he's like, I'm not going any further, man. This is it. And we were all kind of shocked by that. And he told me about what happened to him. Now, from the Native American perspective, right, from the indigenous peoples, to have a property and a land that is affecting him that way, was that a surprise to you when you filmed America Unearthed there and something happened to him?
No, I wasn't, because we had reached out to the indigenous people before, including Black Eagle, several years. I mean, I got it's probably 8-10 years ago, the first time we filmed with Dennis America Unearthed. And it was actually one of, I think it was the first or second episode that we filmed. And at one point, I remember it was the most, it had the highest ratings of all 49 episodes that we did. So that tells you something about the interest level there. But I talked to Black Eagle and other indigenous people, and all they would say is, we didn't build that place. That's not ours. And frankly, you know, we think it's haunted. We don't go there, and we didn't go there in the past. So if it wasn't the indigenous people, then who the hell was it? Right? Because clearly, right now, it's, you know, the colonists that first came there after Chris, right? So if not them, there's only, you know, it has to be somebody pre-Columbian.
But you and I talk a lot, Scott, and you're a science-based guy. When they start flinging out stories about it being haunted in a haunted location and a you know, that there's a spiritual activity, how does that start to register for you? Are you, do you, obviously I know you give respect to everybody's belief systems, but have you had paranormal experiences at locations like this?
Well, the answer is yes. And the, I won't go into the whole story, but probably one of the most profound moments I ever had was at the Newport Tower in Rhode Island, which is not very far away from Mystery Hill or America Stonehenge. And it happened on a very important day. It was on the winter solstice, which happens to be my birthday. And I was supposed to be with another person, but that person just suddenly disappeared. And then I was all alone at the tower. And while I was doing this experiment, which turned out to be one of the most profound, meaningful moments of epiphany that I've had in research my entire life, this woman showed up and said, what are you doing in there? And I told her I had permission and I was going to watch this illumination event. She stayed there the entire time and even took a picture of me at the moment that this egg-shaped keystone illuminated. And then she gave me back the camera and I said, thanks. And I turned around to take another picture. I'd been doing this for 45 minutes. It took maybe 3 to 5 seconds. And when I turned around, she had disappeared. And I didn't even tell anyone about this for a long time because, you know, this is not science. This doesn't happen, right?
Right.
But it changed my thinking. And I'll be honest with you, every year since that happened, that was in 2007, I go back to the tower. And I tell people I go there because I want to see the illumination as a birthday present to myself, which is true. But the real reason I go back is to see if that woman shows up again, because I'll never forget her face, and she hasn't shown up.
Like two ships passing in the night.
Yeah.
Let's do this. We have to take a quick break. Before we do, let's take a quick peek at next week's episode. Don't Send Them to Heaven, The Possession in Waterford. You can watch that episode only on Discovery Plus. That airs this coming Saturday. Let's take a quick sneak peek.
We are now inside a living room with fireplace in the downstairs part of this house. Do you feel any impressions you could describe?
A woman crying.
There's a woman that lived here. What I keep feeling is she would lose consciousness for periods of time
and not remember. I fear her being so angry.
But not remembering. It's like amnesia. I think upstairs it will start to make more sense. There's the attic, right? There's the attic. There's something with a boy that hides in the attic.
Dave, anything in the file?
When Ethel was here, she was connecting with a woman who was trying to find a little boy.
You are on the right track. Keep going with that.
Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way. The best in paranormal talk radio continues. You're listening to Darkness Radio.
Hey, everybody. My name is Cliff Schrader. My father is Dave Schrader from the Holzer Files. And I am a Minneapolis fireman for the city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And for the last 7 years now, I believe, every year we've been taking part in the Polar Plunge for Special Olympics and raising money. And all of you, my father's listeners and friends of listeners and everybody have been the heart of our donors and the reason that we've been able to raise so much. And it is that time of year again, and I am taking the plunge on April 17th, which, you know, it's good for me, might be a little warmer out, but it's that time of year again to try to raise some money for a great cause at Special Olympics. And if you guys have any interest in donating, go ahead and email my father at dave@darknessradio.com. And then he'll be able to drop you a link for your secure donations to Polar Plunge. And my goal this year is $10,000.
Yeah, last year we raised $5,000. We're hoping to help the Special Olympians around the world by raising more money for their uniforms, their travel, and their experiences. So if you're able to help, you can email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and I'll send you a link. Lots of you did that last week. Thank you very much from the bottom of our hearts. We really appreciate all the help you guys have given in doing that. Before we go any further, let's take one more quick look. We've got next week's episode. Believe it or not, folks, we're down to just 3 episodes left of the best in paranormal TV programming. The Holzer Files returns next week, and then 2 more weeks after that, and then the end of season 2. But let's take another look at next week's episode.
I bought this house not knowing that it was haunted. It was my neighbors who told me. I was down at their house having a cup of tea, and they just said to me, "Do you know that you live in a haunted house?"
And how soon into living here did activity begin for you?
Probably about 4 years in. The first thing that happened to me was I was sitting in the living room, and I heard footsteps. They were in the hallway, right outside the door. They seemed to come to the door and then it stopped.
How often would these footsteps take place?
Well, I just had it happen again yesterday.
Yesterday?
Yes, up the stairs.
I am super psyched about this new episode. It's an amazing piece of history, and we stumble upon a secret of the house that we were unaware of when we went in. And I can't wait for you guys to see it and the experiences, the evidence that we capture. That's this Saturday on Discovery Plus. Today, we are talking about last week's episode, Ancient Evil, filmed at America's Stonehenge. And amazing story, lots of great stuff. And Alexandra Holzer was able to join us on this investigation and be a part of the program. She got a chance to follow in her father's footsteps and help us investigate this spot. This is the one time this year where the stars aligned for us. Even with COVID at its height, we were able to connect. And Alex, you got to come on out and spend some time at America's Stonehenge. And I know it wasn't nearly enough time for any of us, but how overwhelmed were you? And I don't mean in a bad way, but just overwhelmed by the power, the energy of this location.
I was overwhelmed internally, trying to keep it together. And I think the one thing that I had the most fear was in the moment when we were standing in the woods. And growing up, and even though we grew up in the city in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, there's the Hudson River. We had a nice park with forests and trees. We'd go away to the country, blah, blah, blah. Is when there's no crickets and there's no sound. Dave, you and I stood there and we're like, shh, shh, shh. Do you hear that? And we're like, no, we hear nothing. And I said, that's not good. That's not good. No. Because they get quiet when danger is approaching. And that was that moment when I sat there. I got a little bit closer to Dave. I said, okay, what's next? Let's move around to the more rocks over here or something. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Because, well, you know, you feel your own humanity at that moment. You're vulnerable. And I don't care who you are. You're going to feel it.
So. It was eerily quiet. That's why when you see Cindy, because I'm sure to the outside, it was a weird edit. When we hear the owl and Cindy stops, she's like, an owl. It looks kind of silly, but the fact was, it was so quiet. I mean, dead. I'm not an outdoors guy, but I live in Minnesota. You open the windows, all I can hear are frogs croaking and crickets chirping and birds tweeting and badgers playing poker with hooker beavers. I don't know what they're doing out there, but they're out there making all this racket. And we're out there in the middle of this wilderness. Not a sound. And then all of a sudden, and it was like it filled the air. It was really creepy and chilling in that moment. And then we're thinking, there's been UFO sightings. People relate owls, and especially large owls, with aliens. We're in the middle of the woods where there's nobody else around and all kinds of weird stuff. And human sacrifice has taken place or animal sacrifice. And you're right. The eerie quiet was one of the most unsettling moments, I think, for the entire cast and crew.
Yeah.
But have you ever been outdoors and it's that quiet ever?
No. And actually, let me tell you something. I listened for it because, you know, when the weather changes here in New York, you know, you want to keep your window open and you want that fresh air to come in. It makes it worse because I'm like this by the screen. Do you hear anything? Do you hear? My husband's like, and he's from Alabama originally. He's like, would you just quit that and go to bed? And I'm like, I got to make sure I hear something. Because if I don't, I'm not going to bed. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like this thing. But no, and the other part of it was that, you know, listen, we talk about, we always feel a heaviness. We walk into an environment, obviously, because there's those that came before you, yada, yada, not always from this planet. I do believe with reptilians and don't get me started. But the point is, there's other beings that we derive from as well. And you don't know what you're really dealing with. And I felt suffocated. So when we started moving around, I felt literally tons of energy forms around us, like an army of them stacking back just like this. And what are you going to do? You can't even see your target. Like, what are you going to do? And that to me was really inwardly frightening.
Well, we had a beautiful full moon. We did have ambient light, but you're right. It was creepy in that setting underneath. We're down in that Oracle chamber. And one thing that didn't make it, which really, it was a freaky moment, as we were standing there and I'm talking and Alex has her back to the opening of the Oracle Chamber, and we're chatting, and all of a sudden behind her, I just see this flash of light, like a burst of lightning went off behind her. And I was like, whoa. And when I reacted, I felt so bad because I had this shocked, terrified look. Alex, like, practically Scooby-Dooed into my arms, and she's like, what? And I'm like,
it's either you or the stone wall. I'm like,
no, I don't blame you.
So poor Dave, he's like, oh, that happens all the time. I'm a big guy. And I'm like, well, this is really quite embarrassing.
No, but there was nothing embarrassing about it. I just felt bad because my reaction was so overcharged. But there was just this discharge of light, and it was right behind you. Then a few minutes later, we've got the IR lights, we've got the camera lights, and we had asked if we could take some pictures. So our camera guy flipped his exterior light on, and you were knocking out some pictures on your dad's camera. We had high speed film, and I'm not a camera guy, but I talked to our director recently because people were questioning how we got that picture. And he said it was like 3200 ASA, blah, 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 whatever. I don't know at all, but they had it set for you so that we were going to get the best shots we could. And as you saw, there was one picture of me in the cave doing the EVP work, that picture, and then we got the shadowy cloaked figure standing outside the door. But that was, you could definitely feel you were not alone. I felt like when we were down in that Oracle Chamber, like we had a group standing around us looking over our shoulders and just trying to figure out what we were doing.
Like, what is this? You people again? It's like, you know, come on already, give it a rest, you know? But I was like, well, give us some information that we could like walk away with, and, you know, maybe we'll go away for a while. But, you know, it's the intention that we set forth and the respect, because you do not know what you're dealing with at the end of the day. I don't care who you are. Even with a crystal ball, there's just too much there. And there's too much history that's not accurate. And, you know, we have an inkling of trying to just find out information, but just being respectful of the ancients, really, because here we are. I feel like we were trespassing, even though that wasn't our intention. And right. Never my father's intention, whenever he would go on a case or talk to people in general just to get the story, he was always very respectful, even if he thought they were full of BS. He would sit there and go, yeah, okay, this is what you think? Okay, thank you very much. Because, you know, it's so wrong to do that to people, because they really believe. You have to respect that belief. Do you know what I'm saying? And then you just...
Well, I totally do.
So.
All right. Now, I want to ask Dennis on this. Dennis, when I describe the flash of light, have you guys ever had people talk about these kind of bursts of light that just happen out of nowhere up in that area?
We've had a few of our visitors talk about that. We've had the paranormal experience in October, and some people have reported some of this, and they've actually captured some things on film too, you know. And some members of the actually with a black cloaked figure. And I don't want to mention which family members, but when we showed them that, I had described it after the reveal, and I mentioned it to the family. They're quite interested in it. They've never come forth to tell anybody. They don't want to discuss it. It was actually two of them. And when we saw the program the other day on Saturday, you know, it was quite meaningful to this particular person. The other person wasn't here, but they both kind of cloaked. More of the cloak thing, I think, more with my family anyway. But definitely the flashes with other people up there talking about it.
Well, I want to ask the forensic geologist real quickly about that, because I do know that stones and crystals hold energy. Is there a scientific explanation, Scott, that stone would emit any kind of light like that, a natural discharge?
Well, I have to be honest with you and tell you that I'm not that versed in the internal energies that minerals hold. However, I will say that we do know that when rocks are exposed to ultraviolet radiation from the sun, that it does alter their makeup. It will alter their crystal lattice to some degree. It will excite the molecules inside of them, and it will change their energy states to a certain degree. And that is why there are certain optical stimulus, OSL, optical stimulation luminescence, OSL. And basically what it is it measures how much change has occurred inside of a quartz crystal. And the longer it's been exposed to UV light, the more it changes. And then there's also the opposite, where if it's buried, the longer it has not been exposed to UV light, that can be measured also. So it's, in a way, it's kind of like C14 dating, where you are measuring the amount of energy that is left, knowing that when this carbon was alive, it had 100% energy, and then whatever you have left, you can back calculate to when it was 100% to get an age. So we do know that we can do this type of dating, and I have to believe that it changes the energy output, if you will, of these various minerals and the rocks that the minerals are in. So I need to learn more about it, but okay. I don't know how much is really known at this time. There's a lot more work to be done.
Well, we talk about the stone tape theory. Are you familiar with that?
The stone tape theory?
Right, that the environment records. Yeah, the environment, especially stone, masonry, things like that, will record things almost like a video camera, that sometimes it just lets it go and then it replays, which might make sense for what happened with Alex and I. We saw this discharge of energy, then the shadowy figure walked by. A few moments later, we captured some crazy activity up by the sacrificial slab. And so I was just curious if you're familiar with that aspect of the phenomena for the paranormal. But let me twist real quickly.
Question, sure. If I could, Dave, when this happens, do you think this is triggered by the people that are there and the work that you were doing and the energy that you were putting into the site itself, and that the site was actually responding? Is that a correct interpretation?
I believe that that's an aspect of it. And you're a paranormal investigator as well, Alexandra. What do you make of that? Do you think that it was because of our intention being in there, what we were hoping to accomplish, that that's what helped spark this energy to be released and be seen?
Here's the thing. People bring different energies, different intentions. They have different backstories. They have different, we're in a certain incarnate right now. We believe in reincarnation. So we have other lives before. It's all rolled into this like really icky, interesting ball, if you will, of energy, which is life. And I do believe that certain presence of the living that show up in a certain location can invoke something that maybe the next group may not. It really depends if they want to come out and show themselves or not. I think it's a collective consciousness of energies that they choose to engage in or not. They're intelligent forms. They're very well aware of all that's going on. So I do believe that people can change the outcome of what may or may not happen in that moment when we're trying to collect data and find out what's going on.
Visit Alexandra's website at alexandraholzer.com. If you want more information about America's Stonehenge, go to stonehengeusa.com. And we'll have links for that in today's program guide. If you'd like more information on Scott Walker and his amazing research and book, check out hookedx.com, H-O-O-K-E-D, and then the letter X.com. Let's talk about the sacrificial table, if you don't mind, Scott, because, this old site, it's going to have a sacrificial table. But there's truth to that, right? And you mentioned in the episode, the Phoenicians would actually sacrifice their children, but it wasn't in a murderous way. It wasn't kind of looked upon, and I know this sounds horrible and I'm not trying to make it okay, but it was really an honor to have your child picked to give to the gods, to give to this thing, right?
Right. Exactly. And so, it's all about context, right? I mean, on one hand, if let's say you were a hiker and you're hiking on Mystery Hill, or maybe a native hiking on Mystery Hill, and you don't realize you're lost, and all of a sudden you come across this scene where a group of people have this child on this table and they sacrifice this child, you'd be just devastated. You would be, oh my God, I can't believe this. But if you were one of those people that believed that by sacrificing this child, that it would bring good things to your community, it would bring good weather, food and all these things. And therefore, if you were the parents of this child in that culture, it may have been an honor to offer your child. So it's all about context. And But I will tell you this, the sacrificial table is an amazing slab of rock just in itself. But Dennis, as you and I have talked about, it's been exposed to the elements for a long time. And when I look at that slab, it just reeks of age. It's old. But having said that, it really is sort of at an advanced stage of weathering. And I'm going to call you out, Dennis. I think it needs to be protected. And I know that it changes the ambiance when people come there. The table is wide open. But I still think you need something to keep the moisture off of it. Because, you know, we think living in the moment that we're here. But look, you took this place over from your father, and maybe Kelsey will take it over and people in the future. And, you know, now's the time to set that precedent to preserve these things. We've got to preserve it because it's such a treasure.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Plus the damage done to it, you know, that vandalism is also compromised the table too, on top of that. So, yeah, we're taking your word, Scott. We're just trying to plan something that will look good, but it will protect it at the same time. So, you know, we're thinking about it, some sort of permanent covering for it. So we are taking your advice for sure. It's covered right now. We cover it,
okay.
We have to cover it now for about a year, unfortunately.
Like a glass coverings. You know, just like a tabletop glass. So you know how people actually have rocks in their house with a glass cover, and that becomes an end table or coffee
yeah.
table? Why not make it like a coffee table?
That would work. Or maybe, you know, something higher up that's slanted that just the moisture off. You know, a little bit of moisture, but it when it's saturated and it freezes and thaws and that's what really tears it apart. So however you can keep it dry as you can, that's the key.
You know, this is the same advice my wife gives me about my ball pen.
Now, you need some covering.
So we go up to investigate, and I'm bouncing around muting mics. I apologize, Scott and Dennis. I'm going to mute you for a second. When all of you were open, we're getting weird looping noises. But Alex, we went up to the sacrificial table. You and I did the investigation outside for a while. Then we went down into the oracle chamber. We had some strange activity and energy down there that was traceable. We actually, and this is really strange, when we were down there, and I still have them on my phone because I transferred them, we recorded EVP of what sounded like children. Do you remember that, Alex?
I do.
And laughter and speaking. And the two of us were blown away. When I took the recorder home back to the hotel and I went to transfer it, I have the recording, but you can't hear anything. There's no sound. We heard the giggling of children and the spoken words of what sounded like children. This very small voice chittering away. And it got really unnerving for both of us. And again, as parents, you know, you're in this situation, it gets uncomfortable. We decide to go up by the slab and we call the rest of the team together. And this is kind of our big reveal at the end of the night. Let's do a little psychometry on the table. Let's do some EVP work. We set some of our tools on the table to see if any of it would resonate. We were getting responses on the obelisk. It was speaking to us. And especially, like, you know, we're children murdered here, and it says solstice. And to get an immediate response, and I don't know, I'll throw back to you real quickly, Scott, during the summer solstice, during one of the solstice, would that have been when they would have made these sacrifices?
Absolutely. I mean, there would have been rituals at every solstice, every equinox, the cross quarter days. I mean, these were very important times of the year that, you know, back then they weren't 100% sure that, you know, things were going to repeat themselves every year. So they wanted to be sure that, you know, that the sun would come back after the winter solstice, that spring would come, new life, and of course the harvest in the fall. And so they would have rituals. And look, we still have these rituals today. People still celebrate these things, and we do something to honor that time of the year. But back then, it would have been a matter literally of life and death. So they absolutely would have paid attention to these important times of the year.
And so we're up there, Alex, trying to make communication. We're getting responses on the equipment. We're getting EVP. We're getting corroboration that whatever's there is doesn't seem real happy. And we could actually sense it. I mean, I know you're a sensitive and Cindy's sensitive. And you two were both like on edge. You could see it. She's like, whatever energy here does not want us here. Can you explain that to viewers that might not be able to really understand how that impacts you? What does that energy feel like to you?
Yeah, it's unnerving. It's like, you know, walking into a place for the first time and not understanding why you should leave, but you're supposed to be there and you just got there. And so it's almost like you have to go on blind faith that you're not welcome for whatever reason. And she and I looked at each other and we're like, I think we've about spent the time we had here. And not to say that we can't go back and do it again or during the day or have a different moment. But in that moment, which is really what we're focused on, because you can't know what's going to happen, you're in the present, right? So it's just unnerving. Or getting ready to have surgery. You have to have a procedure done. You can't get out of it. You're getting prepped. The doctor comes in joking, oh, everything's good. Ha, ha, ha. Meanwhile, you just want to like get the F out of there. You have to go through it. So it's the same feeling. You have to go through it. It's a process. And then you'll come out on the other side and then you can look back and process what just happened and learn from that moment. So it's just like that, you know, you're kind of frozen in time, but you gotta work through it and you have take control.
You're picking up the energy. Cindy's picking up the energy and there gets to the point where it's almost like the spirits are like, we've given you enough tonight. And we were being respectful like your father would have. When he would get to a point when the spirits wanted to end it, would end it. Yeah. And that would go in. Now, Dennis, I want to bring you on again because I find this fascinating. You've had people, and I know you don't want to say who they are close to you because they want anonymity, but they've had some scary encounters up there, correct?
Yeah, back in the 1990s, they did, about a little over 20 years ago. And because I was flying at the time, so I was on the road a lot, but I'd come home and I'd hear some of the stories. And I tried to get them to talk to you, and, you know, but they... 20 years later, they still do not want to talk to them. But they did see some things on the show that really struck my wife, you know. So, in fact, after she says, I wish I could walk around with Cynthia, which is interesting. So we know it's my wife is one of them. But the other one I won't mention, you know, who it was. Because they just don't want to really discuss it, you know. So people have tried to pry it out of the family. But I didn't experience it myself, you know, but they definitely have. Yep.
Now we're coming into the end, folks. We'll stand for about another 10, 11 minutes here. If you have questions, feel free to throw out some questions. I'll try to get to them and throw them up for our crew, whoever you want to direct the question to, or just say general, and I'll throw it out to our panel here to go forward with. We get that activity. We review the evidence. We capture what we believe to be this cloaked figure kind of looking around the door frame at Alex and I. We captured some EVP. You know, this ownership of these spirits, you know, letting us know that they're there, they're affecting our equipment, they're doing all of this. I got to ask you, Scott, again, just going at it from a different perspective, were you surprised by the evidence and surprised by the type of activity we were encountering at a place you've been to many times?
The simple answer is no. Even though this is a little out of my wheelhouse, I know enough to be a little bit dangerous. And if there's any site anywhere that I've been to that I think that you would end up having, you know, paranormal activity, and I got to believe that when you have a place where there have been many people over a long period of time that have come to a place and done something and done things like rituals, like live in a place, bury their dead, do these, you know, deeply profound things that human beings do, I mean, if there's any place, anywhere, where this activity would be present, it would be at America's Stonehenge.
I got a question. Marie says, Dave, would you go there again? I have already thrown it out there, and I would be more than happy to return. I said, how about if we go back for a Mysteries and Histories at America's Stonehenge? Scott Walter, Alexandra Holzer, and myself, and Dennis Stone, what do you guys say? We do a nice little event when this COVID nonsense lifts and we get out there and we take people into the history and we take people into a couple of ghost hunts. Would you guys be up for that?
I think we should do like a 2-hour special on it. It deserves that. A mini documentary.
Anytime I can go to America's Stonehenge and look at the rocks, look at the chambers, spend time with Dennis, Alexandra, I'd love to meet you. Count me in.
Kate Marone says, can we see the photos? Sure you can. Watch the Holzer Files on Discovery Plus. That's the best way to see those photos because that's where we put them. I am only allowed to show some of the stuff that didn't make it on the episode, some of the pictures when I get a chance. With that said, I've got some cool behind the scenes stories for next week. The week after, we're going to visit the Queen Mary. The following week, we're out in, I think it's Maine, Blood on the Rock story, which is really heartbreaking. That's our season finale. But in that one, I actually have our director of photography, Rob Toth, who's going to join me along with some of the other cast members to talk about the season finale and talk about what it's like to really work. So you guys can ask questions of the actual cameramen and sound guys that have been there. I do have to ask you a quick question, if you don't mind, Dennis. You were a pilot. Did you ever see UFOs?
Mostly in the ground. I saw one about a month and a half ago out my front window looking towards the west, towards the approach to a Manchester airport where I used to fly in and out of. And I saw this very, very bright light. It didn't seem to be along the plane of the ecliptic. It seemed to be too north, like Venus. You know, it seemed to look like Venus, but it was too much to the right, to the north. And as I watched it, all of a sudden it went vertically straight down in a flash. You've seen that UFO over the dome in Israel, the one that sits there and then it goes straight up? This one did the reverse of that. And I have to say that was the most, I think, impressive thing I've ever seen. I told my wife, she didn't believe me. I tried to convince her. I said, but it was one flash of a second. It was instantaneous, right to the ground. It either went to the ground or headed west. But it was, I've never seen anything quite like that. Flying, it's just so hot. You know, when you're flying, I did a lot of flying on the UPS system at night, several hundred hours doing that for about 2.5 years. And I flew with guys that saw things, you know, Vietnam pilots and stuff like that. And we would see things at night, but they're just so far away. They were not close encounters. You know, like, what is that thing? You know, and then it would just blink out. It could be a landing light. It could be something. But on the ground back in the 1960s, coming back from one of our friends who was one of our researchers' camp up in the middle of New Hampshire, with one of my friends whose father was an air traffic controller, air route traffic control center supervisor, and he had stories about UFOs. But on the way back, about 66, we saw one in the car. It does remind me of what I saw about a month and a half ago, except that one stayed still. And then we said, well, maybe, and we went around it, an outer belt of Manchester, New Hampshire again. And the next day it was, you know, they were talking about it. So I think that's the other one I saw on the ground back in 66 and then about a month and a half ago. The one a month and a half ago really impressed me, though. I mean, it was amazing. It was right to the ground, you know, amazing.
All right, Scott, Marie Salas here pops up and she says, Scott, have you ever had a paranormal experience? Now, I know you talked about the woman that showed up, but have you ever had any other weird ghostly or UFO monster, any kind of activity?
Well, So we did an episode in Utah about 8 years ago.
Okay.
And you know, I went scuba diving there. We did an underwater drone, but a fan actually watched the show. This was only a month and a half ago and did a screen grab and said, hey, Scott, were you guys flying a drone up in the air that day? And I zoomed in on this picture. And here was this silver kind of capsule shaped object. And it was just hanging in the sky. So a week later, I went over to the production company, Committee Films, and I talked to one of the editors, and I showed him the picture, and I said, hey, could you pull up the raw video? And he said, sure. So we did, and we watched that entire scene, the raw video, and there was a UFO flying, and it was sort of bobbing up and down like this, and it was rotating, and you could see the reflection off of it. It had to have been a metallic surface, and it went across for about 5 to 6 seconds, and nobody the whole time when we were there filming noticed anything. And it was 8 years later, a fan spotted it when watching the episode. So is that a paranormal experience? I'm not really sure. It happened 8 years ago and I didn't know anything about it, but yet, you know, it was discovered by this person that watched the show. And we're trying to figure out what the heck it was. Was it there because we were there? Because we were in the middle of nowhere. I can't imagine what else it would be unless it was just cruising by.
All right. I want to make a quick mention. I have had a guest attempting to get on Darkness Radio now for the better part of a few months, and he wants to talk about the flat Earth theory. He is a believer. He wants to talk flat Earth, and he said, and I'm even happy to debate it as long as it's civil conversation. So there was only one guy I could think of. So in about 7 to 8 weeks, folks, make sure you tune into Darkness Radio. Keep tabs on it. You can hear us on any podcast platform or just ask your smart device to play the new episode of Darkness Radio. But Scott Walter has agreed to come on and talk about the flat Earth theory, and we're going to have a fun, open debate about that. So thank you for agreeing to do that, Scott. Now that I've made it public, you can't back out.
Oh, my God. Thanks a lot there, brother. I appreciate that.
Martin Leakey is a huge flat Earth guy. And then John Levy, which is, do you know, have you heard of John Levy as well? He's got this whole channel. I think he was worked in the government a long time ago. He's like one of those guys, you know, and goes into Tartaria and actually the civilizations that came before and the mud floods and all that. That's another, it goes into flat Earth theories as well. But Martin Lee, can't really understand him. I think he's, oh my God, it's so bad. Scottish or something, but he talks like this. And I'm like, I got his book though. So I'll
start. Excellent. Well, speaking of books, a lot of people don't know this, Alex. Your father wasn't just America's ghost hunter. He wrote books on UFOs, psychic phenomena, Reverend Pike, Bishop Pike, witchcraft. Your father kind of covered the whole gambit, right? What fascinated him most besides ghosts?
Let me tell you something. When I was about 6 years old, our apartment faced the Hudson River, and then off in the distance, you could see the George Washington Bridge all lit up, and across for the river was Jersey. Okay. So he used to stand in front of the window and he'd be looking out. And so I would go up to him and I'd be like, Daddy, what are you doing? He's like, Alex, I'm looking up. And I'm like, why? He's like, because they're moving around. And that's when I started to get a crash course on that we weren't alone. He said that he met people that were men in black for real. He also had claimed that he met hybrids. And I've got to be honest with you, his interest and passion really was on other life forms that inhabited this planet where everything was much different, that The Hobbit and Middle Earth and all these stories came from truth, that we had giants to fairies all cohabitating, if you will, and something took them out. And then that's why I've been studying about reptilians. And like I said, that's another topic. But the point is, he was more fascinated with other life forms and their ships and where they come from and how they live and, you know, other star planets and things like that versus ghosts. Because I think everything was ghost this, ghost that, haunting this, because that was the genre that he ended up becoming successful in. And he was wonderful with it because he had the compassion and the intellect and the studies for it. But he really was like, yeah, life and death in between. Okay, great. What I'm really interested in is how many other life forms exist and what are the other planets like? Some are like Earth, some are like Mars, you know, some are not, you know, inhabitable at all. I mean, it's a whole thing. And that was his main thing. But nobody wanted to publish his books on UFOs or hybrids or men in black. They didn't. It wasn't a hot topic back then in the 50s and 60s. But ghosts and demons and stuff. So that's kind of, he was, you know, and he had a family to support. So I understand that. That's why my interests really carry on from that. And I appreciate everything with the ghosts and the hauntings. But I'm really about shapeshifters and life forms and other planets and the ships. I mean, we stargaze all the time and we watch and we see ships flying over the house at times. And we've got the kids into it. And of course, this is their legacy too. And we'll be out there like idiots going, and then I'm like, I don't see anything. And all of a sudden, and they wink out. I'm like, that's not a helicopter, that, you know? And so you start to put your intellect together after you just realize, what did I just see? And then they hover, you know, and that's really, and that would have been his thing. If he was still around today, would have been more studies into that and interviewing people that claim that they're reptilians living here amongst us as well. You know, you see the slits. If you ever watch those videos, there's a whole compilation, a lot of great footage. Some of it, you're like, yeah, okay, right. But there's a lot of great footage where the slits go in and out. And then the eyes, because the lids go like that. And I'm like, and then I can't go to bed at night. So
real quick, I do want to, I got a bunch of emails on this. People noticed my ring during this episode. And they want to know then if I'm part of the Knights Templar or Freemasons, or am I just part of some illicit dark cult? No, this is my wedding ring. My wife bought it for me because I thought it was really nice and a beautiful ring. And she bought it for me, and it became my wedding ring. It's got the cross. It's a beautiful piece. I've shown it to Scott. He's like, we got to make you earn it, Dave. We got to get you doing better things than just saying it's your wedding ring. So in the future, maybe I'll find one of these great organizations that I'll have time to participate with and become one of the brotherhood. So that's our plan. Brian wants to know, is Alexandra going to be on more episodes? And then we'll answer the second part of this in a second. I know if it's up to the rest of the Holzer Files cast, we'd love to have her out, especially for season three. That was so much fun to have you on board for this episode, Alex, and to get a chance to interact. And it was a thrill for me. I never got to investigate with your dad, but you and I have been friends for 15 years, and we've been to a few places like Eastern State Penitentiary and Waverly Hills and a few places. And I look forward to investigating with you every time. But would you be happy to come back and do another investigation or five or 10?
Hey, the powers that be want me. All they got to do was ask. You know?
All right. Now, I get this question a lot. People want to know, are we going to try to communicate with your father on site during the filming of any of these episodes? My answer has been pretty stock. He's already in communication with you, and I feel if Hans wants to be heard, he'll make himself heard at these locations. But out of respect for his spirit and the work that he did, we don't call on your father to help us.
It's like, it's hokey, you know, to do that. It's like,
right,
digging up. That's like saying, you know, Michael Jackson's dead. Let's now go try to contact the spirit. If his family's around still, it's great that what we're doing, but there's a line, you know, and I do communicate with him, and we've been cataloging everything. I didn't ask for this. I have other family members that have crossed over that I would like to speak to too. This is part of, you know, there's a very unique thing happening here. And I was born into this family for a very specific reason. My sister could receive him as well. She doesn't. And then she'll bother me. Well, what does daddy say now? And I'm like, oh, my God. Go to work and don't worry about money. OK, it'll come. So, you know, it's a burden. It's not pleasant. And I sob a lot of the times because when I'm in that state where I'm kind of in the sleeping, that REM cycle, and he comes to me. And he puts me in a room that I don't want to be in from when I was a child growing up in our apartment. And we have to confront each other, and he's trying to explain things. And it's ESP. We're all talking through our mind, but I know exactly what's going on. And he's showing me things, and I have a lot of questions. There was moments after he had just died, I had an argument with him because I was very angry at him. And there's a lot of things that happened growing up. And that's the daughter to the father. But I have to share this with everybody watching it. So for me personally, I did talk to him when we were at Mystery Hill. I went outside to have my schmoke, and I said, Dad, please just keep us safe. I really would appreciate that. And those that you're working with right now, just keep us all safe. And that's what I do. I would like to communicate. I've done it before. I have it on film. When I worked with other teams, he came through and we have that. And I'm open to do that, but I'd like to be that oracle, if you will,
right, that
conduit, because I am. And it's not by choice, and it's not to say, oh, look at me, I'm the daughter. You know, that's the easiest thing to go and point at. And it's so stupid, because anybody that knows me knows I've put myself out there for 20 years. I have never been anything but genuine. I don't want this, but it's all I have. And I miss him. And if I can have that with him, I've got to learn to understand why he's still around and what we're doing here. So,
right. So if we ever do communicate through Hans, it'll be with Alex on set and him making his presence known to her and to us that way. So that'll hopefully answer your question. There was one other quick question, Alex, about all the masks behind you. Are those yours, or were they your father's?
Those are Dad's. And there's more. I had to split them with my sister. Can I tell you? So not that it's bad enough that we lose a parent. You have to go through that whole grieving process and, you know. She goes, well, I like these masks that Daddy had, and they're gold. And I'm like, but they're not real. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, who cares? She's like, well, you can have these. So I get the weird ones that are like, some are from Japan, China, Mexican. And then I've got one behind that's like the V mask. Like when that film came out, I don't know where it is.
Guy Fawkes. Yeah.
Yeah, we have, it's like a little, and I, this is predating the movie. So he would go to the flea markets and he would find these exotic looking masks, but there's every type that you can imagine. And they all have stories behind them and the energy. So in this house, we're filled. And then we have the files in the basement. Thank you very much. And all his stuff and the reel-to-reels. And it's like going down there, I'm like, I have to do the freaking laundry. And I feel like I got to look over my shoulder, you know, because all the stuff, it's like that, it, you know, so.
Right.
These are his. He was a huge mask nut. We had the entire living room wall, which was very long, dedicated to any type of mask you can think of.
Very cool. Well, Alex, as we're wrapping up, what's going on? How can people reach out to you? How can they get copies of your dad's books? And can they get readings from you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll help people. Like I told you before, I don't, it's a lot for me to do. I don't like to disappoint anybody. So if I'm meant to read for somebody, then I know it's going to be a good connection because that's how it works. People can find all of Dad's books on Amazon.com. Just type in his name and they'll pull up. We've digitized a lot. We're still digitizing more. I have a new book coming out for young adults in the late spring. And we're working on other projects, you know. So there's going to be more Haunts coming out as well. And everything's digital now, you know, it's like, it's so sad, but we're trying to, I'm still trying to get some, you know, print done as well to keep that in audio.
Right. Exactly. Well, Alex, it's always a pleasure catching up with you, and hopefully we'll catch up with you again sometime in the next 3 weeks for our season finale and get together. So thanks for popping in again, honey. I appreciate it. We love you. Please stay safe.
You too. Love you guys. Thank you. Love you, Dave.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Walter, people can check out your website. Let me get the right one up here. HookedX.com. You have got episodes of America Unearthed on Discovery Plus. You made your appearance with us on the show with Holzer Files. What else is coming up in your neck of the woods in your future here? Well, I suppose it'd help if I open up your microphone for you. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yep, there you are.
Well, if we, it looks like we're going to start to have some live appearances again. And you know, I do a lot of lecturing. I really enjoy that. And we have some, quite a number of events that are coming up here in the next several months. I'll be going out to New York, as a matter of fact, in a couple of weeks, giving a lecture to a Masonic lodge. But we are talking with some people about maybe doing some more television, possibly, with some of the research we've been doing with Freemasonry, the Knights Templar, and some of the artifacts that we brought to the world on America Unearthed and how they all connect. Because really, everything that we've investigated, really everything that you investigate, is all part of one great big giant matrix, and it's a continuum that everything is connected together. So we're hoping that you might see us down the road telling a really fantastic story. So stay tuned for that. The other thing I'd like to say is if people are interested in going to my blog, it's Scott Walter Answers. And if you want to go on there, just Google Scott Walter Answers and you'll see all kinds of things, including America's Stonehenge. I've talked about that. And if you have a question, submit it and I'll answer.
A lot of people saw this scene and they said, those two guys have a lot of charisma together. When are you guys going to do a TV show together? Scott, we got to make it happen. What do you think?
I love it, man. I, you know, I'm game for anything. And, you know, I had a great run with America Unearthed, and, you know, if it never comes back, that's fine. I'm happy to come on a show like yours. I've been on other people's shows. I don't have to be the host. I'm just happy to participate. What I want to do is get the information out there. I want to advance it along, educate people, teach people. That's what you like to do. And you know what? It's just fun. So anything you you come up with, Dave, I'm sure I'll be game for it.
What do you want people to be left with your thoughts and ideas about America's Stonehenge?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's one of the most important archaeological sites in North America, without question. You know, I think it's connected to the Phoenicians. It may be older than that. But the truth is, we just don't have enough information, enough data to say for sure. And I just wish that, you know, more academics would take it seriously. I mean, Dennis is the easiest guy in the world to work with. He's, you know, he's fun. He's obviously very knowledgeable, and he's willing to work with people that are serious about getting to the truth about his site. And so it's an opportunity just waiting there for somebody to make a name for themselves. It's one of the most important sites I've ever visited, and it's a real treasure. It's a treasure that this country needs to respect more.
I appreciate it, Scott. It's always a pleasure catching up with you. Dennis, as we're about to say goodbye, StonehengeUSA.com. People can go to your website and can be a part of it and see what's going on. Are you guys open during this time?
Yeah, we're actually open every day of the year except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we stayed open during COVID-19. We closed the visitor center. We just opened that up about a week ago. And if they go to our website, they can actually do a complete virtual tour by downloading an app under America Stonehenge. And it actually talks to you, has pictures and text. So you can do a complete tour at home. And it's also very good when you come to the site, walk around with it on your smartphone, and it takes you on a complete tour that way. And Scott said some really nice things about the site, and we deeply appreciate that. And unfortunately, we just lost one of our archaeologists, our chief archaeologist. She just retired. After being with us for about 32 years. She was a past president of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. So Scott mentioning getting people interested in the site and research. Yeah, we have a void now. She was with us for decades, and she's going to visit us, but I think she's getting into her 80s, so, and she's in Florida right now. And we did have some research, and Scott's well aware of this. We're just waiting for results, and they could be out this week. I'm a little anxious and excited about it at the same time. And Scott talked about it earlier, the optically stimulated luminescence testing. And I believe seven places between New England and New York, three in New Hampshire. And our site was done. They took four cores. And we were supposed to wait up to about a year, but they moved it up to half a year, which would have been April. And now it's been moved forward to possibly this week. We may get some results back on. And it'll be preliminary results because they put these little sensors in the coring holes, and they take them out after 1 year, and they usually have to calibrate the dating. So we may find something out possibly tomorrow. And it's a little nerve-wracking, you know. What will the results be, you know? And I know Scott's thinking away there. I can see him.
Right. So keep us educated. Know, right?
Yeah. It's the latest technology, and we did use ground penetration radar to map the site where the cores were taken at the Oracle Chamber. We had one at the Watch House, but they couldn't use the GPR there. And we LIDAR'd 15 acres of the site so far.
Wow.
And it was LIDAR, and they actually mapped that too. It's about 600 hours of processing. And I think I sent some pictures to both of you about the LIDAR, and they really show up the site, the serpentine walls, and where the cores were taken. So maybe we'll have something this week.
Well, you know, from the Holzer family and the Holzer Files family, thank you, Dennis, for keeping a place like this open and available to the public so that they can come and educate themselves and see that there's much more to the history that we've been taught and so much more that we need to educate ourselves on. And thank you for making that place available.
And we deeply appreciate everybody, Scott's show and your show. We deeply appreciate everybody coming down and support you giving us. So the family thanks all of you, too.
Thank you. That's it for this week, kids. We are done. It's been a pleasure talking with Alexandra Holzer, Dennis Stone, and of course, my good buddy Scott Walter, fellow Minnesotan here, as we've had a lot of fun doing this. Let me remind you, we only have three episodes left of season two of the Holzer Files. If you want to see more Holzer Files, blow up Twitter. Let people know more. Hashtag Holzer Files at Discovery Plus. Just hammer them. Let them know you want more of the best in paranormal TV programming. Next week, it continues. Season two of the Holzer Files continues March 6th, 2021. Don't send them to heaven. The Possession in Waterford, Maine. It's an amazing story you don't want to miss out on. I hope that you'll all check that out. Remember to listen to the best in paranormal talk radio 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday on whatever platform you listen to your favorite podcasts, or go to your app store through iTunes or through Google Play and get the free Darkness Radio app. And that way you can take along and listen to our show anytime, any place, anywhere. Stay safe, love one another. We'll be back again with you guys next week right here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis back at home, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.